though the differences might seem trivial to me. Still, when had the right to live as one wished ever been considered trivial? Was a struggle to choose one's own destiny less worthwhile than the necessity to stop a great evil? I shifted irritably, gingerly rubbing my sore bottom. I glared at Jamie, curled into a ball by the door. He was breathing evenly but lightly. Perhaps he couldn't sleep either. I hoped not. I had been inclined at first to take this whole remarkable misadventure as melodrama. Such things just didn't happen in real life. I had had many shocks since I stepped through the rock, but the worst to date had been this afternoon. Jack Randall, so like and so horribly unlike Frank. His touch on my breasts has suddenly forged a link between my old life and this one, bringing my separate realities together with a bang like a thunderclap. And then there was Jamie, his face stark with fear in the window of Randall's room, contorted with rage by the roadside, tight with pain at my insults. Jamie. Jamie was real, all right, more real than anything had ever been to me. Even Frank and my life in 1945. Jamie, tender lover and perfidious blackguard. Perhaps that was part of the problem. Jamie filled my senses so completely that his surroundings seemed almost irrelevant. But I could no longer afford to ignore them. My recklessness had almost killed him this afternoon, and my stomach turned over at the thought of losing him. I sat up suddenly, intending to go and wake him to tell him to come to bed with me. As my weight fell full on the results of his handiwork, I just as suddenly changed my mind and flounced angrily back onto my stomach. A night spent thus, torn between fits of rage and philosophy, had left me worn out. I slept all afternoon and stumbled blearily down for a light supper when Rupert roused me just before dark. Dougal, no doubt writhing at the expense, had procured another horse for me. A sound beast, if inelegantly built, with a kindly eye and a short, bristly mane. At once I named Thistle. I hadn't reckoned on the effects of a long horseback ride following a severe beating. I eyed Thistle's hard saddle dubiously, suddenly realizing what I was in for. A thick cloak plopped across the saddle, and Murta's shiny black rat eye winked conspiratorially at me from the opposite side. I determined that I would at least suffer in dignified silence, and grimly set my jaw as I hoisted myself into the saddle. There seemed to be an unspoken conspiracy of gallantry among the men. They took turns stopping at frequent intervals to relieve themselves, allowing me to dismount for a few minutes and surreptitiously rub my aching fundament. Now and again one would suggest stopping for a drink, which necessitated my stopping as well, since Thistle carried the water bottles. We jogged along for a couple of hours in this manner, but the pain grew steadily worse, keeping me shifting in the saddle incessantly. Finally, I decided to hell with dignified suffering. I simply must get off for a while. "Whoa," I said to Thistle, and swung down. I pretended to examine her front left foot as the other horses came to a milling stop around us. "I'm afraid she's had a stone in her shoe," I lied. "I've got it out, but I'd better walk her a bit. Don't want her to go lame."
"No, we can't have that," said Dougal.
"All right, walk for a bit then, but someone must stay with you. 'Tis a quiet enough road, but I cannot have you walking alone."
Jamie immediately swung down.
"I'll walk with her," he said quietly. "Good. Dinna tarry too long. We must be in Bagrennan before dawn. The sign of the Red Boar. Landlord's a friend."
With a wave, he gathered the others, and they set off at a brisk trot, leaving us in the dust. Several hours of torture by saddle had not improved my temper. Let him walk with me. I was damned if I'd speak to him, the sadistic, violent brute. He didn't look particularly brutish in the light of the half-moon rising, but I hardened my heart and limped along, carefully not looking at him. My abused muscles at first protested the unaccustomed exercise, but after a half hour or so, I began to move much more easily.
"You'll feel much better by tomorrow," Jamie observed casually, "though you won't sit easy till the next day."
"And what makes you such an expert?" I flared at him. "Do you beat people all that frequently?"
"Well, no," he said, undisturbed by my attitude. "This is the first time I've tried it. I've considerable experience on the other end, though."
"You?" I gaped at him. The thought of anyone taking a strap to this towering mass of muscle and sinew was completely untenable. He laughed at my expression.
"When I was a bit smaller, Sassenach, I've had my backside leathered more times than I could count between the ages of 8 and 13. That's when I got taller than my father, and it got unhandy for him to bend me over a fence rail."
"Your father beat you?"
"Aye, mostly. The schoolmaster, too, of course, and Dougal, or one of the other uncles now and then, depending on where I was and what I'd been doing."
I was growing interested, in spite of my determination to ignore him. "What did you do?" He laughed again, a quiet but infectious sound in the still night air.
"Well, I cannot remember everything. I will say I generally deserved it. I don't think my da ever beat me unfairly, at least."
He paced without speaking for a minute, thinking.
Let's see. There was once for stoning the chickens, and once for riding the cows and getting them too excited for milking, and then for eating all of the jam out of the cakes and leaving the cakes behind. Ah, and letting the horses out of the barn by leaving the gate unlatched, and setting the thatch of the dovecot on fire. Oh, that was an accident. I didn't do it on purpose. And losing my school books. I did do that on purpose, and..."
He broke off, shrugging, as I laughed despite myself.
"The usual sorts of things. Most often, though, it was for opening my mouth when I should have kept it closed."
He snorted at some memory.
"Once, my sister Jenny broke a pitcher. I made her angry, teasing, and she lost her temper and threw it at me. When my da came in and demanded to know who'd done it, she was too scared to speak up, and she just looked at me with her eyes all wide and frightened. She's got blue eyes like mine, but prettier, with black lashes all around."
Jamie shrugged again.
"Anyway, I told my father I'd done it."
"That was very noble of you," I said sarcastically. "Your sister must have been grateful."
"Aye, well, she might have been. Only my father had been on the other side of the open door all along, and he'd seen what really happened. So she got whipped for losing her temper and breaking the pitcher, and I got whipped twice, once for teasing her, and again for lying."
"That's not fair," I said indignantly.
"My father wasn't always gentle, but he was usually fair," Jamie said imperturbably. "He said the truth is the truth, and people should take responsibility for their own actions." "Which is right."
He shot me a sidelong glance.
"But he said it was good-hearted of me to take the blame, so while he'd have to punish me, I could take my choice between being thrashed or going to bed without my supper."
He laughed ruefully, shaking his head.
"Father knew me pretty well. I took the thrashing with no questions."
"You're nothing but a walking appetite, Jamie," I said.
"Aye," he agreed without rancour. "Always have been." "You too, glutton," he said to his mount. "Wait a bit till we stop for a rest."
He twitched the reins, pulling his horse's questing nose from the tempting tufts of grass along the roadside.
"Aye, father was fair," he went on, "and considerate about it, though I certainly didn't appreciate that at the time. He wouldn't make me wait for a beating. If I did something wrong, I got punished at once, or as soon as he found out about it. He always made sure I knew what I was about to get walloped for, and if I wanted to argue my side of it, I could."
"Oh, so that's what you're up to," I thought. "You disarming schemer." I doubted he could charm me out of my set intention of disemboweling him at the first opportunity, but he was welcome to try. "Did you ever win an argument?" I asked.
"No.
It was generally a straightforward enough case, with the accused convicted out of his own mouth. But sometimes I got the sentence reduced a bit."
He rubbed his nose.
"Once I told him I thought beating your son was the most uncivilized method of getting your own way. He said I'd about as much sense as the post I was standing next to, if as much. He said, respect for your elders was one of the cornerstones of civilized behaviour, and until I learned that, I'd better get used to looking at my toes while one of my barbaric elders thrashed my arse off."
This time I laughed along with him.
It was peaceful on the road, with that sort of absolute quiet that comes when you are miles from any other person. The sort of quiet so hard to come by in my own more crowded time, when machines spread the influence of man, so that a single person could make as much noise as a crowd. The only sounds here were the stirring of plants, the occasional squeak of a nightbird, and the soft thudding steps of the horses. I was walking a little easier now, as my cramped muscles began to stretch freely with the exercise. My prickly feelings began to relax a little too, listening to Jamie's stories, all humorous and self-deprecating.
I didn't like being beaten at all, of course, but if I had a choice, I'd rather my da than the schoolmaster. We'd mostly get it across the palm of the hand with a tawse in the schoolhouse instead of on the backside. Father said if he whipped me on the hand, I'd not be able to do any work, whereas if he whipped my arse, I'd at least not be tempted to sit down and be idle. We had a different schoolmaster each year. Usually they didn't last long. Usually he turned farmer or moved on to richer parts. Schoolmasters are paid so little, they're always skinny and starving. Had a fat one once, and I could never believe he was a real schoolmaster. He looked like a parson in disguise.
I thought of plump little Father Bain and smiled in agreement.
One, I remember especially, because he'd make you stand out in the front of the schoolroom with your hand out, and then he'd lecture you at great length about your faults before he started, and again in between strokes. I'd stand there with my hand out, smarting, just praying he'd stop yammering and get on with the job before I lost all my courage and started crying.
I imagine that's what he wanted you to do, I said, feeling some sympathy in spite of myself.
Oh, aye, he replied matter-of-factly. It took some time for me to realise that, though, and once I did, as usual, I couldn't keep my mouth shut.
He sighed. What happened?
I had all but forgotten to be furious by this time. Well, he had me up one day. I got it a lot because I couldn't write properly with my right hand, kept doing it with my left. He'd smacked me 3 times, taking nearly 5 minutes to do it, the bastard. And he was going on at me for being a stupid, idle, stubborn young lout before giving me the next. My hand burned something fierce because it was the 2nd time that day, and I was scared, because I knew I'd get an awful thrashing when I got home. That was the rule. If I got a beating at school, I'd get another directly I came home, for my father thought schooling important. Anyway, I lost my temper.
His left hand curled involuntarily around the rein, as though protecting the sensitive palm. He paused and glanced at me.
I seldom lose my temper, Sassenach, and generally regret it when I do.
And that, I thought, was likely to be as close to an apology as I'd get. Did you regret it that time?
Well, I doubled up my fists and glared up at him. He was a tall, scrawny fellow, maybe 20, I suppose, though he looked quite old to me. And I said, I'm not afraid of you, and you can't make me cry no matter how hard you hit me.
He drew a deep breath and blew it out slowly.
I suppose it was a bit of a mistake in judgment to tell him that while he was still holding the strap.
Don't tell me, I said. He tried to prove you were wrong?
Oh, aye. He tried.
Jamie nodded, head dark against the cloud-lit sky. His voice held a certain grim satisfaction on the word, tried. He didn't succeed then. The shaggy head shook back and forth.
No, at least it couldn't have made me cry. He surely made me regret not keeping quiet, though.
He paused for a moment, turning his own face toward me. The cloud cover had parted for a moment, and the light touched the edges of jaw and cheek, making him look gilded, like one of Donatello's archangels.
When Dougal was describing my character to you before we wed, did he by chance mention that I'm sometimes a bit stubborn?
The slanted eyes glinted, much more Lucifer than Michael. I laughed.
That's putting it mildly. As I recall, what he said is that all the phases are stubborn as rocks and you're the worst of the lot.
Actually, I said, a little dryly, I'd noticed something of the kind myself. He smiled as he reined the horses around a deep puddle in the road, leading mine by the check rein after him.
Well, I'll no just say Dougal's wrong, he said, once the hazard had been negotiated. But if I'm stubborn, I come by honest. My father was just the same, and we'd get in wrangles from time to time that we couldn't get out of without the application of force. Usually with me bent over the fence rail.
Suddenly he put out a hand to grab my horse's rein as the beast reared and snorted.
Hey now, hush. Stadmaru.
His own, less spooked, only jerked and tossed its head nervously. What is it? I could see nothing despite the patches of moonlight that mottled road and field. There was a pine grove up ahead, and the horses seemed disinclined to go any nearer to it.
I don't know. Stay here and keep quiet. Mount your horse and hold mine. If I call to you, drop the check rein and run for it.
Jamie's voice was low and casual, calming me as well as the horses. With a muttered "Skur!" to the horse, and a slap on the neck to urge it closer to me, he faded into the heather, hand on his dirk. I strained eyes and ears to discern whatever it was still troubling the horses. They shifted and stamped, ears and tails twitching in agitation. The clouds by now had shredded and flown on the night wind, leaving only scattered trails across the face of a brilliant half-moon. In spite of the brightness, I could see nothing on the road ahead or in the menacing grove. It seemed a late hour and an unprofitable road for highwaymen, scarce as these were anywhere in the highlands. There were too few travellers to make an ambush worthwhile. The grove was dark, but not still. The pines roared softly to themselves, millions of needles scouring in the wind. Very ancient trees, pines, and eerie in the gloom. Gymnosperms, cone-bearers, winged seed-scatterers, older and sterner by far than the soft-leaved, frail-limbed oaks and aspens, the suitable home for Rupert's ghosts and evil spirits. Only you, I thought crossly to myself, could work yourself up into being afraid of a lot of trees. Where was Jamie, though? The hand gripping my thigh made me squeak like a startled bat, a natural consequence of trying to scream with your heart in your mouth. With the unreasonable fury of the irrationally afraid, I struck out at him, kicking him in the chest. "Don't sneak up on me like that!" "Hush!" he said. "Come with me." Tugging me unceremoniously from the saddle, he swung me down and hastily tethered the horses, who whickered uneasily after us as he led me into the tall grass. "What is it?" I hissed, stumbling blindly over roots and rocks. "Quiet. Don't speak. Look down and watch my feet. Step where I step, and stop when I touch you." Slowly, and more or less silently, we made our way into the edges of the pine grove. It was dark under the trees, with only crumbs of light falling through to the needle litter underfoot. Even Jamie couldn't walk silently on that, but the rustle of dry needles was lost in that of the green ones overhead. There was a rift in the litter, a mass of granite rising from the forest floor. Here, Jamie put me in front of him, guiding my hands and feet to climb the sloping crumble of the mound. At the top, There was enough room to lie belly flat side by side. Jamie put his mouth next to my ear, barely breathing. 30 feet ahead, to the right, in the clearing. See them? Once I saw them, I could hear as well. Wolves. A small pack, 8 or 10 animals perhaps. No howling, not these. The kill lay in the shadow, a blob of dark with an upthrust leg, stick-thin and vibrating under the impact of teeth yanking at the carcass. There was only the occasional soft growl and yip as a cub was battered away from an adult's morsel, and the contented sounds of feeding, crunching, and the crack of a bone. As my eyes grew more accustomed to the moon-flecked scene, I could pick out several shaggy fawns stretched under the trees, glutted and peaceful. Bits of grey fur shone here and there, as those still at the carcass pushed and rooted for tender bits overlooked by the earlier diners. A broad, yellow-eyed head thrust suddenly up into a blotch of light, ears pricked. The wolf made a soft, urgent noise, something between a whine and a growl, and there was a sudden stillness under the trees below. The saffron eyes seemed fixed on my own. There was no fear in the animal's posture, nor curiosity, only a wary acknowledgement. Jamie's hand on my back warned me not to move, though I felt no desire to run. I could have stayed locked in the wolf's eyes for hours, I think, but she, I was sure it was a female, though I didn't know how I knew, flicked her ears once, as though dismissing me, and bent once more to her meal. We watched them for a few minutes, peaceful in the scattered light. At last, Jamie signalled that it was time to go, with a touch on my arm. He kept the hand on my arm to support me as we made our way back through the trees to the road. It was the first time I had willingly allowed him to touch me since he had rescued me from Fort William. Still charmed by the sight of the wolves, we didn't speak much, but began to feel comfortable with each other again. As we walked, considering the stories he had told me, I couldn't help but admire the job he had done. Without one word of direct explanation or apology, he had given me the message he intended. "I gave you justice," it said, "as I was taught it. And I gave you mercy, too, so far as I could. While I could not spare you pain and humiliation, I make you a gift of my own pains and humiliations, that yours might be easier to bear." "Did you mind a lot?" I said abruptly. "Being beaten, I mean. Did you get over it easily?" He squeezed my hand lightly before letting it go.
"Mostly I forgot it as soon as it was over. Except for the last time. That took a while."
"Why?"
"Ah, well, I was 16 for one thing, and a man grown, I thought. For another, it hurt like hell."
"You don't have to tell me about it if you don't want to," I said, sensing his hesitation. "Is it a painful story?"
"Not nearly as painful as the beating," he said, laughing. "No, I don't mind telling you. It's a long story, is all."
"It's a long way to Bagrennan yet."
"So it is." "Well, then, you recall I told you I spent a year at Castle Leoch when I was 16. It was an agreement between Colum and my father, so I'd be familiar with my mother's clan. I fostered with Dougal for 2 years and then went to the castle for a year to learn manners and Latin and such."
"Oh, I wondered how you'd come to be there."
"Aye, that was the way of it. I was big for my age, or tall at least. A good swordsman even then, and a better horseman than most."
"Modest too," I said.
"Not very. Cocky as hell, and even faster with my tongue than I am now."
"The mind boggles," I said, amused. "Well, it might, Sassenach."
I found I could make people laugh with my remarks, and I made them more frequent, without caring much what I said or to whom. I was cruel sometimes to the other lads, not meaning it, just not able to resist if I thought of something clever to see.
He looked up at the sky to gauge the time. Blacker still, now that the moon had gone down. I recognised Orion floating near the horizon and was strangely comforted by the familiar sight.
So, one day I went too far. I was with a couple of the other lads going down a corridor when I saw Mistress Fitzgibbons at the other end. She was carrying a big basket, near as big as she was, and bumping to and fro as she walked. You know what she looks like now. She wasn't a much smaller then.
He rubbed his nose, embarrassed.
Well, I made a number of ungallant remarks concerning her appearance. Funny, but most ungallant. They amused my companions considerably. I didn't realise she could hear me as well.
I recalled the massive dame of Castle Leoch. While I had never seen her other than good-humoured, she didn't appear to be the sort of person to be insulted with impunity.
What did she do?
Nothing. Then. I didn't know she'd heard until she got up at the hall gathering next day and told Colum all about it.
Oh, dear.
I knew how highly Colum regarded Mrs. Fitz, and didn't think he would take any irreverence directed at her lightly.
What happened?
The same that happened to Lear. Or almost.
He chuckled.
I got very bold, though, and I stood up and said I chose to take my beating with fists. I was trying to be very calm and grown up about it all, though my heart was going like a blacksmith's hammer, and I felt a bit sick when I looked at Angus's hands. They looked like stones, and big ones at that. There were a few laughs from the folk gathered in the hall. I wasn't as tall then as I am now, and I weighed less than half as much. Wee Angus could have torn my head off with one blow. Anyway, Colum and Dougal both frowned at me, though I thought they were really a bit pleased I'd had the nerve to ask it. Then Colum said, no, if I was going to behave like a child, I'd to be punished like one. He gave a nod, and before I could move, Angus bent me across his knee, turned up the edge of my kilt, and blistered me with his strap in front of the entire hall.
Oh, Jamie.
Mm-hmm. You'll have noticed Angus is very professional about his work. He gave me 15 strokes, and to this day I could tell you exactly where each one landed.
He shuddered reminiscently.
I had the marks for a week.
He reached out and broke a clump of pine needles from the nearest tree, spreading them like a fan between thumb and fingers. The scent of turpentine was suddenly sharper.
Well, I wasn't allowed just to go quietly away and tend to my wounds either. When Angus finished with me, Dougal took me by the scruff of the neck and marched me to the far end of the hall. Then I was made to come all the way back on my knees across the stones. I had to kneel before Colum's seat and beg Mrs. Fitz's pardon, then Colum's, then apologise to everyone in the hall for my rudeness, and finally I had to thank Angus for the strapping. I nearly choked over that, but he was very gracious about it. He reached down and gave me a hand to get up. Then I was plunked down on a stool next to Colum and bid to sit there till hall was ended.
He hunched his shoulders protectively.
That was the worst hour I ever had. My face was on fire and so was my arse. My knees were skinned and I couldn't look anywhere but at my feet. But the worst of it all was that I had to piss something awful. I almost died. I'd a burst before I wet myself in front of everyone on top of it all. But I was a near thing. I sweated right through my shirt.
I suppressed my urge to laugh. Couldn't you have told Colum what was the matter? I asked.
He knew perfectly well what was the matter. And so did everyone else in the hall, the way I was squirming on that stool. People were making wagers as to whether I'd last or not.
He shrugged.
Colum would have let me go, if I'd asked. But, well, I got stubborn about it.
He grinned a bit sheepishly, teeth white in a dark face.
Thought I'd rather die than ask, and nearly did. When at last Colum said I could go, I made it out of the hall, but only as far as the nearest door. Threw myself behind the wall and spurted streams. I thought I'd never stop. So,
he spread his hands deprecatingly, dropping the clump of pine needles.
Now you know the worst thing that ever happened to me.
I couldn't help it. I laughed until I had to sit down at the side of the road. Jamie waited patiently for a minute, then sank down on his knees.
What are you laughing for? He demanded. It wasn't funny at all.
But he was smiling himself. I shook my head, still laughing. No, it isn't. It's an awful story. It's just... I can see you sitting there, being stubborn about it, with your jaw clenched and steam coming out of your ears.
Jamie snorted, but laughed a little too.
Aye, it's no very easy to be 16, is it?
So, you did help that girl, Leah, because you felt sorry for her, I said when I had recovered my composure. You knew what it was like. He was surprised.
Aye, I said so. It's a lot easier to get punched in the face at 23 than to have your bum strapped in public at 16.
Bruised pride hurts worse than anything, and it bruises easy then. I wondered. I'd never seen anyone grin in anticipation of being punched in the mouth.
Couldn't have very well do it afterward.
I nodded agreement. I thought, I said, then stopped in embarrassment.
You thought what? Oh, about me and Liar, you mean, he said, divining my thought. You and Alec and everyone else, including Liar. I'd have done the same if she'd been plain.
He nudged me in the ribs,
though I didn't expect you'll believe that.
Well, I did see you together that day in the alcove, I defended myself, and somebody certainly taught you how to kiss. Jamie shuffled his feet in the dust, embarrassed. He ducked his head shyly.
Well now, Sasnach, I'm no better than most men. Sometimes I try, but I dinna always manage. You know that bit in St. Paul where he says, 'tis better to marry than burn? Well, I was burning quite badly there.
I laughed again, feeling light-hearted as a 16-year-old myself. So you married me, I teased, to avoid the occasion of sin.
Aye, that's what marriage is good for. It makes a sacrament out of things you'd otherwise have to confess.
I collapsed again. Oh, Jamie, I do love you. This time it was his turn to laugh. He doubled over, then sat down at the roadside, fizzing with mirth. He slowly fell over backward and lay in the long grass, wheezing and choking. "What on earth is the matter with you?" I demanded, staring at him. At long last he sat up, wiping his streaming eyes. He shook his head, gasping.
"Murta was right about woman. Sasnach, I risked my life for you, committing theft, arson, assault and murder into the bargain. In return for which you call me names, insult my manhood, kick me in the bollocks and claw my face. Then I beat you half to death and tell you all the most humiliating things that have ever happened to me. And you say you love me."
He laid his head on his knees and laughed some more. Finally he rose and held out a hand to me, wiping his eyes with the other.
"You know, very sensible, Sasnach, but I like you fine. Let's go."
It was getting late, or early, depending on your viewpoint. And it was necessary to ride if we were to make Bargrennan by dawn. I was enough recovered by this time to bear sitting, though the effects were still noticeable. We rode in a companionable silence for some time. Left to my own thoughts, I considered for the first time at leisure what would happen if and when I ever managed to find my way back to the circle of standing stones? Married to him by coercion, and dependent on him from necessity, I had undeniably grown very fond of Jamie. More to the point, perhaps, were his feelings about me. Linked at first by circumstance, then by friendship, and finally by a startlingly deep bodily passion, still, he had never made even a casual statement to me about his feelings. And yet... He had risked his life for me. That much he might do for the sake of his marriage vow. He would, he said, protect me to the last drop of his blood. And I believed he meant it. I was more touched by the events of the last 24 hours, when he had suddenly admitted me to his emotions and his personal life, warts and all. If he felt as much for me as I thought perhaps he did, what would he feel if I suddenly disappeared? The remnants of physical discomfort receded as I grappled with these uncomfortable thoughts. We were within 3 miles of Bargrennan when Jamie suddenly broke the silence.
"I haven't told you how my father died,"
he said abruptly. "Dougal said he had a stroke. An apoplexy, I mean," I said, startled. I supposed that Jamie, alone with his thoughts as well, had found them dwelling on his father as a result of our earlier conversation, but I couldn't imagine what led him to this particular subject.
"That's right. But it... he..."
He paused, considering his words. Then he shrugged, abandoning carefulness. He drew a deep breath and let it out.
"You should know about it. It's to do with... things."
The road here was wide enough to ride easily abreast, provided only that we kept a sharp eye out for protruding rocks. My excuse to Dougal about my horse hadn't been chosen at random.
"It was at the fort," Jamie said, picking his way around a bad patch, "where we were yesterday. Where Randall and his men took me from Lallybroch. Where they flogged me. 2 days after the first time, Randall summoned me to his office. 2 soldiers came for me and took me from the cells up to his room. The same where I found you. It's how I knew where to go. Just outside, we met my father in the courtyard. He'd found out where they'd taken me, and come to see if he could get me out some way, or at least to see for himself that I was all right.
Jamie kicked a heel gently into his horse's ribs, urging it on with a soft click of his tongue. There was no trace of daylight yet, but the look of the night had changed. Dawn could be no more than an hour away.
I hadn't realized until I saw him just how alone I'd felt there, or how scared. The soldiers would not give us any time alone together, but at least they let me greet him.
He swallowed and went on.
I told him I was sorry. About Jenny, I meant, and the whole sorry mess. He told me to hush, though, and hugged me tight to him. He asked me, was I hurt badly? He knew about the flogging, and I said I'd be all right. The soldiers said I must go then, so he squeezed my arms tight and told me to remember to pray. He said he would stand by me no matter what happened, and I must just keep my head up and try not to worry myself. He kissed my cheek and the soldiers took me away. That was the last time I ever saw him.
His voice was steady, but a little thick. My own throat felt tight, and I would have touched him if I could. But the road narrowed through a small glen, and I was forced to fall back behind him for a moment. By the time I came alongside again, he had composed himself.
"So," he said, taking a deep breath, "I went in to see Captain Randall. He sent the soldiers out so we were alone, and offered me a stool. He said my father had offered security for my bond to have me released, but that my charge was a serious one, and it could not be bonded without a written clearance signed by the Duke of Argyll, whose boundaries we were under. I reckon that was where my father was headed then, to see Argyll. In the meantime, Randall went on, there was the matter of this second flogging I was sentenced to."
He stopped a minute, as though uncertain how to go on.
"He was strange in his manner, I thought. Very cordial, but with something under it I didn't understand. He kept watching me as though he expected me to do something, though I was just sitting still. He half apologized to me, saying he was sorry that our relations had been so difficult to the present, and that he wished the circumstances had been different and so on."
Jamie shook his head.
"I couldn't imagine what he was talking about. 2 days earlier he'd been trying his best to beat me to death. When he finally got down to it, though, he was blunt enough."
"What did he want, then?" I asked. Jamie glanced at me, then away. The dark hid his features, but I thought he seemed embarrassed.
"Me," he said boldly.
I started so violently that the horse tossed its head and whickered reproachfully. Jamie shrugged again.
He was quite plain about it. If I would, make him free of my body, he'd cancel the second flogging. If I would not, then I'd wish I'd never been born, he said.
I felt quite sick.
I was already wishing something of the sort, he said with a glint of humour. My belly felt as though I'd swallowed broken glass, and if I hadn't been sitting, my knees would have knocked together.
But what? My voice was hoarse, and I cleared my throat and started over. But what did you do? He sighed.
Well, I'll no lie to you, Sassenach. I considered it. The first stripes were still so raw on my back I could scarce bear a shirt, and I felt giddy whenever I stood up. The thought of going through that again, being bound and helpless, waiting for the next lash.
He shuddered involuntarily.
"I'd no real idea," he said wryly, "but I rather thought being buggered would at least be a bit less painful. Men have died under the lash sometimes, Sassenach, and from the look on his face, I thought he meant me to be one of them, were that my choice."
He sighed again.
"But, well, I could still feel my father's kiss on my cheek, and thought of what he'd say, and, well, I couldn't do it, that's all. I didn't stop to think what my death might mean to my father."
He snorted, as though finding something faintly amusing.
"Then, too, I thought, the man's already raped my sister. Damned if he'll have me, too."
I didn't find this amusing. I was seeing Jack Randall again in a new and revolting light. Jamie rubbed the back of his neck, then dropped his hand to the pommel.
"So I took what little courage I had left by then and said no. I said it loud, too, and added whatever filthy names I could think of to call him, all at the top of my lungs."
He grimaced.
"I was afraid I'd change my mind if I thought about it. I wanted to make sure there was no chance of going back. Though I dinna suppose," he added thoughtfully, "that there's any really tactful way to refuse an offer like that."
"No," I agreed dryly. "I don't suppose he'd have been pleased, no matter what you said."
"He wasn't. He backhanded me across the mouth to shut me up. I fell down. I was still a bit weak. And he stood over me, just staring down at me. I'd better sense than to try and get up. So I just lay there until he called the soldiers to take me back to my cell."
He shook his head. He didn't change expression at all. Just said as I left, "I'll see you on Friday," as though we had an appointment to discuss business or some such. The soldiers hadn't returned Jamie to the cell he had shared with three other prisoners. Instead, he was put into a small room by himself to await Friday's reckoning with no distraction save the daily visit of the garrison's physician who came to dress his back.
"He wasn't much of a doctor," Jamie said, "but he was kindly enough." "The second day he came, along with a goose grease and charcoal, he brought me a small Bible that belonged to a prisoner who'd died. Said he understood I was a papist, and whether I found the word of God any comfort or not, at least I could compare my troubles with Job's."
He laughed.
"Oddly enough, it was some comfort. Our Lord had to put up with being scourged too, and I could reflect that at least I wasn't going to be hauled out and crucified afterward. On the other hand," he said judiciously, "our Lord wasn't forced to listen to indecent proposals from Pontius Pilate either."
Jamie had kept the small Bible. He rummaged in his saddlebag and handed it across now for me to look at. It was a worn, leather-covered volume, about 5 inches long, printed on paper so flimsy the print showed through from one side of each page to the other. On the flyleaf was written, "Alexander William Roderick MacGregor, 1733. The ink was faded and blurred, and the covers warped as though the book had gotten wet on more than one occasion. I turned the little book over curiously. Small as it was, it must have cost something in effort to keep it by him through the travels and adventures of the last 4 years. "I've never seen you read it," I handed it back.
"No, that's not why I keep it," he said.
He tucked it away, stroking the edge of the worn cover with a thumb as he did so. He patted the saddlebag absently.
"There's a debt owing to Alex MacGregor. I mean to collect it sometime." "Anyway," he continued, returning to his story, "Friday came at last, and I don't know whether I was glad or sorry to see it. The waiting and the fear were almost worse than I thought the pain would be. When it came, though..."
He made that odd half-shrugging gesture of his, easing the shirt across his back.
"Well, you've seen the marks. You know what it was like."
"Only because Dougal told me. He said he was there." Jamie nodded.
"Aye, he was there. And my father as well, although I didn't know it at the time. I'd no mind for anything much beyond my own problems then."
"Oh," I said slowly. "And your father?"
"Mm-hmm. That's when it happened. Some of the men there told me after that they thought I was dead halfway through, and I reckon my father thought so too."
He hesitated, and his voice was thick when he resumed.
"When I fell, Dougal told me my father made a small sound and put his hand up to his head. Then he dropped like a rock and didn't get up again."
The birds were moving in the heather, trilling and calling from the still dark leaves of the trees. Jamie's head was bowed, face still invisible.
"I didn't know he was dead," he said softly. "They didn't tell me until a month later, when they thought I was strong enough to bear it. So I did not bury him as his son should have done. And I have never seen his grave, because I'm afraid to go home."
"Jamie," I said. "Oh, Jamie, dear." After what seemed a long silence, I said, "But you can't feel responsible. Jamie, there was nothing you could have done, or done differently."
"No," he said. "No, maybe not. Though I wonder would it still have happened had I chosen the other way. But to know that doesn't much help the way I feel. And I feel as though I had done him to death with my own hands."
"Jamie," I said again, and stopped, helpless. He rode silently for a bit, then straightened up and squared his shoulders once more.
"I've not told anyone about it," he said abruptly. "But I thought that now you should know, about Randall, I mean. You've a right to know what it is that lies between him and me."
What it is that lies between him and me. The life of a good man, the honour of a girl, and an indecent lust that found its vent in blood and fear. And, I supposed, with a lurch of the stomach, that there was now one more item weighting the scales. Me. For the first time I began to realise what Jamie had felt, crouched in the window of Randall's room with an empty gun in his hand. And I began to forgive him for what he had done to me. As though reading my mind, he said, not looking at me,
"Do you know? I mean, can you understand, maybe, why I thought it needful to beat you?"
I waited a moment before answering. I understood all right. But that wasn't quite all there was to it. "I understand," I said. "And so far as that goes, I forgive you." "What I can't forgive," I said, my voice rising slightly in spite of myself, "is that you enjoyed it." He bent forward in the saddle, clasping the pommel, and laughed for a long time. He revelled in the release of tension before finally tossing his head back and turning to me. The sky was noticeably lighter now, and I could see his face, lined with exhaustion, strain, and mirth. The scratches down his cheek were black in the dim light.
"Enjoyed it? Sassenach," he said, gasping. "You don't know just how much I enjoyed it. You were so... God, you looked lovely. I was so angry, and you fought me so fierce. I hated to hurt you, but I wanted to do it at the same time. Jesus, he said, breaking off and wiping his nose. Yes, yes, I did enjoy it. Though, come to that, he said, you might give me some credit for exercising restraint.
I was getting rather angry again. I could feel my cheeks flushing hotly against the cool dawn air.
Restraint, was it? I was under the impression that what you were exercising was your good left arm. You almost crippled me, you arrogant Scottish bastard.
Did I want to cripple you, Sassenach? You'd know it, he answered dryly. I meant afterward. I slept on the floor, if you recall.
I eyed him narrowly, breathing through my nose.
Oh, so that was restraint, was it? Well, I didn't think it right to Roger you in that state, however fierce I wanted to.
And I did want to, he added, laughing again. Terrible strain on my natural instincts.
Roger me, I said, diverted by the expression.
I would hardly call it love-making under the circumstances, would you?
Whatever you might call it, I said evenly,
it's a good thing you didn't try it, or you'd now be missing a few valued bits of your anatomy.
That thought occurred to me.
And if you think you deserve applause for nobly refraining from committing rape on top of assault...
I choked on my collar. We rode a half mile or so in silence. Then he heaved a sigh.
I can see I shouldn't have started this conversation. What I was trying to do was to work up to asking you, would you allow me to share your bed again, once we get to Bargrennan?
He paused shyly.
It's a bit cold on the floor.
I rode for a good 5 minutes before answering. When I had decided what to say, I reined in, turning across the road so as to force Jamie to stop as well. Bargrennan was in sight, rooftops just visible in the dawning light. I urged my horse parallel with the other, so that I was no more than a foot away from Jamie. I looked him in the eye for a minute before speaking. "Will you do me the honour of sharing my bed, O Lord and Master?" I asked politely. Obviously suspecting something, he considered a moment, then nodded just as formally.
"I will. Thank you."
He was raising the reins to go when I stopped him.
"There's just one more thing, Master," I said, still polite.
"Aye."
I whipped my hand from the concealed pocket in my skirt, and the dawn light struck sparks from the blade of the dagger pressed against his chest.
"If," I said through my teeth, "you ever raise a hand to me again, James Fraser, I will cut out your heart and fry it for breakfast."
There was a long silence, broken only by the shiftings and creakings of horses and harness. Then he held out his hand, palm up.
"Give it to me."
When I hesitated, he said impatiently,
"I'm not going to use it on you. Give it to me."
He held the dirk by the blade upright so that the rising sun caught the moonstone in the hilt and made it glow. Holding the dagger like a crucifix, he recited something in Gaelic. I recognized it from the oath-taking ceremony in Colum's Hall, but he followed it with the English translation for my benefit.
"I swear on the cross of my Lord Jesus, and by the holy iron which I hold, that I give you my fealty and pledge you my loyalty. If ever my hand is raised against you in rebellion or in anger, then I ask that this holy iron may pierce my heart."
He kissed the dirk at the juncture of haft and tang, and handed it back to me.
"I don't make idle threats, Sassenach," he said, raising one brow, "and I don't take frivolous vows. Now, can we go to bed?"
Chapter 23. Return to Leoch.
Dougal was waiting for us at the sign of the Red Boar, impatiently pacing to and fro outside.
"Made it, did you?"
he asked, watching with approval as I dismounted without assistance, staggering only slightly.
"Gallant lass. 10 miles without a whimper. Get up to your bed, then.
You've earned it. Jamie and I will stable the horses.
He patted me very gently on the rump in dismissal. I was only too glad to follow his suggestion, and was asleep almost before my head touched the pillow. I didn't stir when Jamie crawled in beside me, but woke suddenly in the late afternoon, convinced that there was something important I had forgotten. "Horrocks!" I exclaimed suddenly, sitting bolt upright in bed. "Huh?" Jamie, startled out of a sound sleep, shot sideways out of bed, ending on the floor in a crouch, hand on the dirk he had left on top of his piled clothes.
"What?" he demanded, staring wildly around the room. "What is it?"
I stifled a giggle at the sight of him, crouched naked on the floor, red hair standing on end like quills.
"You look like a fretful porpentine," I said.
He gave me a dirty look and rose to his feet, replacing the dirk on the stool that held his clothes.
"You couldn't wait till I walked to tell me that," he inquired. "You thought it would make much more impression if you woke me out of a sound sleep by shouting hedgehog in my ear?"
"Not hedgehog," I explained, "Horrocks." I remembered all at once that I'd forgotten to ask you about him. "Did you find him?" He sat down on the bed and sank his head in his hands. He rubbed his face vigorously, as though to restore circulation.
"Oh, aye," he said through the muffling fingers. "Aye, I found him."
I could tell from the tone of voice that the deserter's information hadn't been good.
"Would he not tell you anything after all?" I asked sympathetically.
That had always been a possibility, though Jamie had gone prepared to part with not only his own money, and some provided by Dougal and Colum, but even his father's ring, if necessary. Jamie lay back on the bed beside me, staring up at the ceiling.
"No," he said. "No, he told me all right, and at a reasonable price."
I rolled up onto an elbow in order to look down at his face.
"Well, then," I demanded, "who did shoot the Sergeant Major?"
He looked up at me and smiled a trifle grimly.
"Randall," he said,
and shut his eyes.
"Randall?" I said blankly. "But why?"
"I don't know," he said, eyes still shut. "I could guess, perhaps, but it doesn't much matter. Damn all chance of proving it."
I had to agree that this was true. I sank back on the bed beside him and stared up at the black oak beams of the low ceiling.
"What can you do then?" I asked. "Go to France? Or perhaps," a bright thought occurred to me, "perhaps to America. You could likely do well in the New World."
"Across the ocean?"
A brief shudder ran through him.
"No. No, I couldn't do that."
"Well, what then?" I demanded, turning my head to look at him. He opened one eye enough to give me a jaundiced look.
"I'd thought, for a start, that I might get another hour's sleep," he said. "But apparently not."
Resigned, he pulled himself up in bed, leaning against the wall. I had been too tired to pull the bedclothes off before retiring, and there was a suspicious black spot on the quilt near his knee. I kept a wary eye on it as he talked.
"You're right," he agreed. "We could go to France."
I started, having momentarily forgotten that whatever he decided to do, I was now included in the decision.
"But there isn't that much for me there," he said, idly scratching his thigh. "Only soldiering, and that's no life for you. Or to Rome, to join King James's court. That might be managed. I've some Fraser uncles and cousins with a foot in that camp who would help me. I've no great taste for politics, and less for princes. But aye, it's a possibility. I'd rather try first to clear myself in Scotland, though. If I did, at the worst I might end up as a small crofter in the Fraser lands. At best, I might be able to go back to Lallybroch."
His face clouded, and I knew he was thinking of his sister.
"For myself," he said softly, "I wouldn't go. But it isn't only me anymore."
He looked down at me and smiled, his hand gently smoothing my hair.
"I forget sometimes that there's you now, Sassenach," he said.
I felt extraordinarily uncomfortable. I felt like a traitor, in fact. Here he was, making plans that would affect his entire